Shalom Hadavarnix. Welcome to our latest session in the 12 Minor Prophets. We are in the book of Nahum. In fact, we'll be finishing up Nahum this session. This is session 31. And we'll be going through Ariel's exegetical outline notes. These are provided by Ariel Ministries on the Minor Prophets. And the notes have been developed by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. And you can pick up your copy of the Nahum class notes on the Hadavar website, as well as the Nahum class handouts on the Hadavar website. So let's review where we were in chapters 1 and 2. We learned in chapter 1 that Nahum ministered during the middle of the prophetic period, between 845 and 424. He's in the middle of that period. We learned that he came from the town, most likely from the town of El-Kasi, located in the Shvela. And this is a map of the divided kingdom, with Judah being highlighted here in the middle in red, and El-Kasi is approximately that location right there. Now remember, the Shvela is located between the Philistine plain on the west and the Judean hills on the east, right in between the rolling hills of the Shvela, the foothills to the Judean mountains, and that was where El-Kasi was located. And here is a photograph of the Shvela as it looks today. Again, a very beautiful area of Israel. Now this prophecy is aimed against Nineveh. It's a prophecy against Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire. And here's a map of the Assyrian Empire. Jerusalem and Israel are on the west here, and to the north and to the east is that capital city of Nineveh. Nineveh will be destroyed. That's the theme of the book, the destruction of Nineveh. And Nineveh was destroyed when the Kosar River, and by the way, this is a map of Nineveh itself, the Kosar River, which ran through the center of the town, and the Tigris River, which ran to the west of the town, were flooded by unseasonably large and unexpected rainfall. And this wiped out a couple miles of the wall, and so the invaders, the Babylonians and Medians, could conquer the city. We learned that the God who conquers Nineveh is the God of the whirlwind. He's also the God of the clouds and the storm. He's the God of water and drought, dryness and crops. He's the God of the mountains and the hills. And I like this picture of Mount Everest. This is the highest mountain range on earth, the Himalayas. And there's Mount Everest topping the Himalayas. Again, God has pushed these mountains up. He's in charge of the mountains and the hills. He's also the God in charge of people, of the inhabitants of the earth. Now, Nineveh disappeared for 1,400 years until a Layard excavated at Kuyunlik here in the ancient city. That was the location of his archaeological expedition. And this book was published a few years after that archaeology was completed, and it shows some of the finds when he excavated Nineveh. And you can see from this drawing, if the drawing is anyway accurate, that Nineveh was had disappeared under 10-15 feet of rubble and dirt. But Nineveh had disappeared for 1,400 years. We also learned that the kings of Nineveh were very vain, proud people. They could never admit defeat, and so they put a positive twist on everything, even if it was a defeat. And we see an example of this in Sennacherib's prism at the Israel Museum. On that prism we read, 46 cities in Judah I devastated and took their spoil. But as for Hezekiah, the king, I shut him up like a bird in a cage. Now, he can't say that he took Jerusalem, but he can put a spin on it and make it seem like he was victorious, shutting up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage. Now, the king who will be deposed and defeated when Nineveh goes down, it was Sardanapalus. And this is a relief of Sardanapalus in the Brooklyn Museum. And the Assyrian kings were also very proud of their brutality. They likened themselves to lions. They like to hunt lions. They like to put lions in their artwork. And this is a picture of Ashurbanipal fighting off a lion. Very idealized relief. He's stabbing the lion through the heart with his sword and holding the lion off at the throat with his arm, with his neck. So I don't think that's exactly what happened, but it shows their boastful nature and the fact that they were brutal and loved to be compared to lions. All right, this brings us to chapter 3 in the book of Nahum. Chapter 3 begins with the reasons for Nineveh's doom. Chapter 3 is verses 1 through 19. So the reasons for Nineveh's doom, first of all, its history of blood. The sin of Nineveh is brought out in chapter 3, verse 1. Woe to the bloody city, completely full of lies and pillage. Her prey never departs. And the point here is that a nation cannot commit crime after crime after crime after crime with impunity. And the Hebrew there is plural. It's Ir Damim, a city of bloods. And the plural indicates much bloodletting, repeated bloodletting. It's full of lies. You know, the Assyrians deceived nations with vain promises of help, vain promises of protection. And a good example of this is found in Isaiah chapter 7. In verses 1 through 14, King Ahaz of Judah wants to go to Assyria for help to defeat his enemies. And so he calls on Assyria. But what does God say to him? Starting in verse 17, he says, "You want Assyria? You'll get Assyria." Verse 17, "The Lord will bring on you, on your people, and on your father's house such days as have never come since the day that Ephraim separated from Judah, the king of Assyria." You want Assyria? You're going to get Assyria. "In that day the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the remotest part of the rivers of Egypt, and for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. And they will come, they will all come and settle on the steep ravines, on the ledges and on the cliffs, and on all the thorn bushes and on all the watering places." In other words, Assyria is going to come on down, and he's going to cover the land with his soldiers. "And in that day the Lord will shave with a razor hired from the regions beyond the Euphrates," that is, the king of Assyria, "the head and the hair and the legs, and will also remove the beard." In other words, when he comes and settles everywhere in the land, he's going to humiliate Judah. He's going to humiliate Judah. So his promise of help to Judah will be vain. No help, rather humiliation. And so the punishment for Assyria and their lies, Nineveh and its lies, is pronounced. And so the battle scene we looked at earlier is resumed in verse 2. "The noise of the whip, the noise of the rattling of the wheel, galloping horses, bounding chariots." And so the conflict is on, and there's a manifold shedding of blood in verse 3. "Horsemen charging, swords flashing, spears gleaming, many slain. A mass of corpses, countless dead bodies. They stumble over the dead bodies." Nahum must be appalled at the vision that he sees. Now, in your notes, there are some paragraphs emphasizing the cruelty of Assyria how they love to be cruel. We're not going to read all those notes, but we'll read a couple of paragraphs. Let's go down to the third paragraph in your notes, starting with the cuneiform tablets. "The cuneiform tablets furnish appalling testimony to the calculated cruelty inflicted by the armies mustered in Nineveh. Ashurbanipal II, 885 to 860 BC, for instance, lists his atrocities in a monument commemorating the first 18 years of his reign." So he boasted, he took pride in his brutality. Now turn over a couple of pages to the very last paragraph in those notes. In your exegetical outline notes, we have some paragraphs on the brutality of the Assyrians. Last paragraph. The atrocious practice. It begins the atrocious practice. "The atrocious practice of cutting off hands and feet, ears and noses, gouging out eyes, lopping off heads, and then binding them to vines or heaping them up before city gates. The utter fiendishness by which captives could be impaled or flayed alive through a process in which their skin was gradually and completely removed. This planned frightfulness, systematically enforced by the bloody city, was now to be avenged." So the bloody city was an early terrorist. They terrorized their people. They knew all about terrorizing their not their enemies, their victims. And I've shown you this before, this relief by the Assyrians depicting their ancient warfare. Let's take a look at it again, and you'll see in graphic terms what they did. This is from Biblical Archaeology Review. Proud of his deeds, Ashurbanipal, 668 to 627 BC, preserved for posterity this ghastly record of how he dealt with the Elamite enemies who lived to the southeast of Assyria. So this is not Jewish people. These are Elamites. In the upper register of the relief shows two naked men lying supine, fastened to the ground with ropes and stakes. So here they are. There's the two men lying on the ground. They can't move. They've been staked there. They can't move. While two Assyrians bending over them with knives flay them. Flaying is to cut the skin off. So they're cutting off their skin slowly and gradually, skinning them alive. It must have been a horrible, horrible, painful experience. To the right of this scene, an Assyrian probably uses strings to carry away a head. So there he is. He's carrying away a head of some Elamite. He's going to take it home to the little woman and put it up on the mantelpiece. In the lower register, at the bottom edge, an Assyrian steadies the head of an Elamite prisoner. So here's that Elamite prisoner on his back, and his head is being steadied by the Assyrian, while another Assyrian tears out the man's tongue. See what he's doing there? He's reaching into his mouth and ripping out his tongue. Ugh. Above them, two Assyrians throw down the next victim, whose arms are tied behind his back. And there's the next poor guy that's going to get his tongue torn out. He's been bashed on the head, it looks like, by a club. And down on his back he goes, and out comes his tongue. The Assyrians loved that kind of stuff. So that's the first reason why they'll be destroyed. Nineveh is a city of blood. Second reason is the involvement of Assyria and Nineveh in the occult. Verse 4 describes the sin. All because of the many harlotries of the harlot, the charming one, the mistress of sorceries, who sells nations by her harlotries and families by her sorceries. So there's a multitude of religious prostitution going on. There's repeated witchcraft, the practice of the black arts. And so the leaders are into religious prostitution and the occult. And not only were they into it, they caused others, like King Ahaz of Judah, to practice the Assyrian occultic practices as well. And this can be seen in 2 Kings 16, 10 through 19, or 10 through 18. In 2 Kings 16 we read, "Now King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria. And he saw the altar, which was set at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Urijah the priest the pattern of the altar and its model, according to all its workmanship. So he sends to Urijah the priest a blueprint of this pagan altar." It wasn't designed by God, it was designed by man. So Urijah the priest built an altar according to all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. Thus Urijah the priest made it before before the coming of King Ahaz from Damascus. So Urijah jumps right to work, and he makes it exactly according to plan. So he's into this as much as King Ahaz is. Then the king came from Damascus, and the king saw the altar, and then he liked it. The implication is that he was very approving of it. Then the king approached the altar and went up on it, and he burned his burnt offering and his meal offering and poured out his drink offering and sprinkled the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. This is a pagan altar now. The bronze altar, which was before the Lord, he brought from the front of the house. And from between his altar and the house of the Lord, he put it on the north side of his altar. So the king Ahaz is practicing the sacrifices of the Mosaic law, but he's doing it on a pagan altar. And then he's altering the layout of Solomon's temple by taking God's altar and moving it away and putting this new pagan altar in the prominent place. Then King Ahaz commanded Urijah the priest, saying, "Upon the great altar, burn," and of course he's calling it the great altar. It may even be bigger than the other one. That may indicate that it was bigger and fancier, and so more attractive to him. "Upon the great altar, burn the morning burnt offering, and the evening meal offering, and the king's offering, and his meal offering. And with the burnt offering of all the people of the land, and their meal offering, and their drink offerings, and sprinkle on it all the blood of the burnt offering, and all the blood of the sacrifice." So there it is again. All the Mosaic offerings being offered in the wrong way on an altar of paganism. And then he refers to the bronze altar that God had dedicated, or he had issued, told, what's the word I'm looking for? On the bronze altar that had been provided by God, had been ordered by God, was a God's altar. But on the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. So he's going to use that altar, but he's going to use it for superstitious usages. So it just shows that King Ahaz is into the occultism of the Assyrians. Verse 16. So Urijah the priest did according to all King Ahaz commanded. So he's just as responsible as King Ahaz was. Then King Ahaz cut off the borders from the stands and removed the labor from them. And he took down the sea from the bronze oxen which were under it, and he put it on a pavement of stone. So again, he's altering the Solomonic Temple again. And the Solomonic Temple was approved by God. The Shekinah glory entered that temple and was approved by God. But now he's taking it and he's modifying it. The covered way for the Sabbath, which they had built in the house, and the outer entryway of the king, he removed from the house of the Lord. Now, why did he do this? Why did he offer sacrifices, the Mosaic law, on a pagan altar? Why did he alter the temple itself, moving the bronze altar out of the way, making these other modifications? He did this all, why? Because of the king of Assyria. There it is in verse 18. He did it because of the king of Assyria. So the king, the Assyrians, influenced even the nations around them to be part of their paganism. All right, the punishment that's going to come upon Nineveh in verses 5 through 7. First of all, Nineveh will be uncovered, will be naked. This is a sign of humiliation in verse 5. Behold, I'm against you, declares the Lord of hosts. I will lift up your skirts over your face and show to the nations your nakedness and to the kingdoms your disgrace. So they're going to be humiliated. And in verse 6, they're going to become a gazing stock, which is even a further humiliation, increase the humiliation. I will throw filth on you and make you vile and set you up as a spectacle. I'm going to humiliate you to the max. And that Hebrew translation of filth, I will throw filth on you, means anything detestable, like throwing rotten tomatoes at an actor on a stage. I'm going to make you as humiliated as I possibly can. And there'll be none to comfort Nineveh, none to feel sorry for her in verse 7. And it will come about that all who see you will shrink from you and say, Nineveh is devastated. Who will grieve for her? Where will I seek comforters for you? So the fall of Nineveh will be a time of rejoicing for her victims. Now that word comforters is the word menachamim. It's a play on Nahum's name. Nahum's name means comfort. So that's a related word. Now there's some comments from the Expositor's Bible Commentary I thought I'd share with you out of Volume 7, Daniel and the Minor Prophets. Pages 482 and 483, we read this. The debacle is still regarded as one of the greatest riddles of world history. Within a span of 80 years, Nineveh, which had been raised to unrivaled prominence by Sennacherib and his successors, was obliterated from living memory. Sennacherib had boasted of his city, Nineveh, the noble metropolis, the city beloved of Ishtar, wherein are all the meeting places of gods and goddesses, the everlasting substructure, the eternal foundation. That's quite a boast, isn't it? Whose plan had been designed from old, and whose structure had been beautiful, along with the firmament of heaven. But the Lord had purposed none of his end, and the imperial city was never rebuilt. Trouble did not come a second time from that quarter. For the next 300 years, at least, there's no evidence that the site of Nineveh was even occupied. Xenophon passed the ruins without recognizing them around 400 BC. Lucian stated, Nineveh has perished and there's no trace left where it once was. Then Layard, he's the man who excavated Nineveh, Layard, one of Nineveh's excavators, wrote as follows, we have been fortunate enough to acquire the most convincing and lasting evidence of that magnificence and power which made Nineveh the wonder of the ancient world, and her fall the theme of the prophets as the most signal instance of divine vengeance. Without the evidence of these that these monuments afford, we might also have doubted that the great Nineveh ever existed. So completely has she become a desolation and a waste. According to the Cambridge Ancient History, no other land seems to have been sacked and pillaged so completely as was Assyria. So there would be no comforters for her. She would be totally destroyed. Now the third reason for Nineveh's fall is her treatment of Noamon in verses 8 through 12. Her sin is described in verses 8 through 10. First of all, Noamon's watery defenses come to the light in verse 8. Are you better than Noamon, which was situated by the waters of the Nile, with water surrounding her, whose rampart was the sea, whose wall consisted of the sea? Now, Noamon is another name for Thebes. Thebes was the capital of Upper Egypt. So Noamon, Thebes, it's the same city, the southern part of Egypt, Upper Egypt. Now, it was surrounded by four channels of the Nile. Now, the Nile was poetically called the sea, in order to emphasize the strong defenses there. You know, the Nile is still called the sea in Arabic to this day, especially during the annual flooding, when the flooded area resembles a sea. So she was surrounded by four channels of the Nile. She had 20,000 chariots. She had 100 gates. So Thebes was better protected than Nineveh, yet Thebes will fall. Now Thebes also headed up many alliances in verse 9. And by the way, here is Nineveh to the north, and to the south here in Egypt is Thebes. This is the location of Thebes. Now, her alliances. Ethiopia was her might, and Egypt too, without limits. Put and Lubim were among her helpers. So here's a modern map of the area, and we'll point out where these ancient locations are. First of all, Thebes is in Upper Egypt right here. This is Upper Egypt to the south. And her ally, her first ally mentioned, is Ethiopia. Well, Ethiopia, biblical Ethiopia, is not modern Ethiopia as we think of today. Biblical Ethiopia we would call the North Sudan. The Nile ran through that area. So Ethiopia, what's North Sudan today. Then Lower Egypt, I was also her ally near the Mediterranean Sea. Then Put. Put is ancient Somaliland. Somaliland in this location here. And finally, the Lubim. Lubim is Libya, what we call modern Libya today. So she had lots of allies all around her and lots of military power. But nevertheless, Thebes fell in chapter 3, verse 10. Yet she became an exile. She went into captivity. Also, her small children were dashed to pieces at the head of every street. They cast lots for her honorable men, and all her great men were bound with fetters. So in spite of her defenses, in spite of her alliances, Thebes was destroyed. It was taken by the Assyrians under Ashurbanipal. And the inhabitants went into captivity, the young children brutally dashed to pieces in the streets, and the leaders divided by lot and became slaves. And there's a paragraph following your notes that describe the incredible Assyrian cruelty against Thebes. And so the judgment is going to come in verse 11. You too, Assyria, Nineveh, you too will become drunk. You too will be hidden. You too will search for refuge from the enemy. You shall be drunken. And they will be drunken with the wrath of God. They will be literally drunken as well when the floods tear out their wall. But being drunken on the wrath of God, a symbolic use of drunkenness, is a common symbol in Scripture. You know, God's wrath is pictured as wine, and the nations drink it to the dregs, and they stagger in drunkenness, stagger in destruction and judgment. Now, you've got a number of examples in your notes there. Let's just share one, Isaiah 51:17. There we read, "Rouse yourself, rouse yourself. Arise, O Jerusalem, you who have drunk from the Lord's hand the cup of his anger, the chalice of reeling you have drained to the dregs." So there's a picture of drunkenness being the wrath of God. And again, it says that Nineveh will be hidden. and it was hidden until 1842 when it was discovered by Layard. So it was hidden for about 1,400 years. And so the emphasis on Nineveh's destruction is repeated in verse 12. All your fortifications are fig trees with ripe fruit. When shaken, they will fall into the eater's mouth. So Nineveh is compared to first ripe figs, always eaten and consumed quickly, delicious. And by the way, figs are rather fragile when they get ripe. They fall off the tree. I have a my neighbor's tree is a fig tree, and if he doesn't pick his figs, I have to pick them up off the ground because the wind shakes them and down they come. So these are first ripe figs. Here's a picture of a man getting ready to enjoy his ripe fig there. And figs off the tree are really good. They're always eaten, consumed quickly. So that's the picture of Nineveh, you know, desirable, something that is going to be consumed by the Babylonians and the Medians. And the point here, if it can happen to Thebes, it can happen to Nineveh. Thebes was better defended, better allied than Nineveh. Now, the fourth reason for Nineveh's fall lies in, your notes say, its homosexuality, verse 13. But I don't know if that's the best description. I think a better description would be in its hedonism. Hedonism is a worshiping of pleasure, going after pleasure. So the sin is brought out in the first part of verse 13. Behold, your people are women in your midst. Now, some commentators feel that this is a reference to weakness and timidity and panic by the soldiers. That the soldiers aren't strong, brutal men, but they're weak, timid, panicky women. Okay. However, Sardanapalus, he was the king, always dressed in female clothes and was surrounded by concubines. He was the king when Nineveh fell. So he was decadent and self-indulgent hedonist to the max. Here's what you read about him when you go to the article on Wikipedia on Sardanapalus. Diodorus says that Sardanapalus exceeded all previous rulers in sloth and luxury. He spent his whole life in self-indulgence. He dressed in women's clothes and wore makeup. He had many concubines, female and male. He wrote his own epitaph in which he stated that physical gratification was the only purpose in life. So I don't think we should pigeonhole him into one kind of sexual sin. He was just a decadent, self-indulgent hedonist. He was into anything that had made him feel good. A hedonist to the extreme, to the extreme. So the punishment comes in the second part of verse 13. The gates of your land are open wide to your enemies. Fire consumes your gate bars. So the gates of your land will open. And that's a prediction that the conquerors will run through the breach in the wall. That breach in the wall will be made by the flooding rivers. And then the city will be burned with fire. That's the manner of its destruction. And that's exactly what happened. So the fall of Nineveh, again, is predicted in verses 14 through 19. First of all, there's a call to the people to prepare for the siege in verse 14. Draw for yourself water for the siege. Strengthen your fortifications. Go into the clay and tread the mortar. Take hold of the brick mold. Now this is the use of irony. It's a call to prepare. Prepare your defenses. Prepare your foodstuffs. A siege is coming. But any preparation for the siege will prove useless. And the destruction will be total in verses 15 through 17. Verse 15, Nahum predicts that Nineveh will be devoured by fire and sword. Their fire will consume you, the sword will cut you down. And that's exactly what happened. The city burned, and the soldiers massacred the inhabitants. And the massive population of people in Nineveh will not be a help in defeating the enemy, defeating the attackers. Now, this massive population of people are described as locusts. They're symbolized as locusts here in verse 16. Excuse me, verse 15, last part of verse 15. It will consume you as the locust does. Multiply yourself like the creeping locust. Multiply yourself like the swarming locust. So again, the population of the city, the people in the city, are pictured as a massive swarm of locusts. In verse 16, Nahum predicts that Nineveh will be looted by her own citizens. as well as Babylon and the Medians, but by your own citizens as well. You have increased your traitors more than the stars of heaven. The creeping locust strips and flies away. So her own citizens will strip her of her riches and leave the city, retreat from the city, run from the city. Now the leaders themselves are powerless. They're going to flee the city. In verse 17, Nahum predicts, your guardsmen are like the swarming locusts. There again, see that comparison to locusts? Your marshals are like hordes of grasshoppers settling on the stone walls on a cold day. The sun rises and they flee. The place where they are is not known. So again, the leaders are pictured as locusts. Locusts are numb and they don't move when it's cold. They settle down when it's cold, but when it warms up, they take wing and off they go. And when the battle got hot, the leaders took off, just like locusts. And so the results of the destruction in verse 18, your shepherds are sleeping, O king of Assyria. Your nobles are lying down. Your people are scattered on the mountains. There's no one to regather them. So after the tumult and clatter of battle, silence settles over Nineveh. The shepherds, they slumber. They slumber the slumber of death. They're the guardians of the city. The nobles, they're at rest. The rest of death. That's the leadership of the city. Those that weren't able to flee were killed. And the population is dispensed beyond any possibility of regathering. And again, some good comments by the Expositor's Bible Commentary on page 489 in regard to this verse. The disappearance of the Assyrian people will always remain a unique and striking phenomenon in ancient history. Other similar kingdoms and empires have indeed passed away, but the people have lived on. Recent discoveries have, and it is true, shown that poverty-stricken communities perpetuated the old Assyrian names and various places, for instance, on the ruined site of Asher, for many centuries. But the essential truth remains the same. A nation which had existed 2,000 years and had ruled a wide area lost its independent character. So Nineveh has disappeared for 1,400 years. And there'll be no comfort for Nineveh in verse 19. There's no relief for your breakdown. Your wound is incurable. All who hear about you will clap their hands over you. And on whom has not your evil For on whom has not your evil passed continually? So Nineveh's wound is not curable. She's not going to rise again. And her victims will rejoice over her fall because they suffered terribly at the hand of Nineveh. And that brings the oracle against Nineveh to a close. And this is a short-term prophecy that validated Nahum. It's a short-term prophecy because it will happen shortly after it is uttered, and there's many details in it. The city will be destroyed by water. That's the rivers overflowing, and by fire. That's what Sardanapalus did. He burned himself and all his concubines and riches in the palace. He set it on fire, committed suicide. And I suppose that was pleasurable, huh? That was an orgy of hedonism. And then the city was destroyed and disappeared. The people, the population disappeared, exactly as Nahum had predicted. So that's the reason why this prophecy is in Scripture. It was a short-term prophecy validating Nahum. It came to pass exactly as stated. Well, let's close with some thoughts of application. This is a theme and application chart for the book of Nahum, chapter 1 through chapter 3. And the theme is God's judgment on Nineveh. Very straightforward theme. Now, what did we see in the biblical text? What was the biblical application? Nineveh was cruel and proud, but at the height of her power. God judged her and freed those under her oppression. Judah, on the other hand, was told to quietly take refuge in the Lord, and he would deliver them. And indeed they were. To which side do you belong? Let's think about some specific questions to ask ourselves. Specific application for us. How can this mean anything to us today? Well, I think the key question I've already stated. To which side do you belong? To which side do you belong? Are you a Ninevite? Do you practice cruel and ungodly behavior toward others? You're proud, you're self-reliant, you're strong, you're macho? You know, Christians can be that way. Arrogant and proud. You're not turning to God, but you're rejoicing in your private idols of money and material things, education, social standing, job, etc., etc., etc. You know, is that where you're coming from? You know, we can be oppressive and cruel with our words and attitudes toward others, much the same way Nineveh oppressed nations. And if we are, we can be sure that God's patience will run out, and he will bring us down in shame. And no one will comfort us, because they'll be relieved when we get what we deserve. So let's not be Ninevites, huh? And here's some references that encourage us not to be Ninevites. Romans 12:3. For through the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you, do not think more highly of himself than he ought to think. In other words, don't be arrogant like the kings of Assyria. Think, but to think so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. You know, think properly of yourself. And then in verse 16, Romans 12, be of the same mind toward one another. Do not be haughty in mind. Haughty in mind, that describes the Assyrian kings. But associate with the lowly. Don't dominate them. Do not be wise in your own estimation. The Assyrians thought they were just the best. And James sums it up. But he gives a greater grace. Therefore it says, God is opposed to the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Just as he opposed the Assyrians, the Ninevites, so he can oppose us. So we should be humble. So, are we going to be like Judah? Are we going to be like Assyria? Are we going to be like Judah? Judah was in the midst of a cruel, oppressive situation. And you may be in the middle of some kind of an oppressive situation at home, at work, at school, wherever you may be. What will be your response? Are you turning to God as your refuge? You know, that's what Nahum said. Turn to God as your refuge, trusting that he is good and he will eventually deliver you. So if you're experiencing this, if this application is touching your heart one way or another, write down the situation that applies to you. Are you a Ninevite, aware now of some bad attitudes? Or are you a Judean in the midst of trouble? What is your situation? If you find yourself identifying with this application, put together a plan of action. Write down something you could practically do to respond to God in this situation. You could memorize scripture, dealing with arrogance, or dealing with patience, dealing with trust, something like that. You can ask forgiveness if you are arrogant and proud. And if you're under oppression, you can seek God in prayer. There's many things you can do. Well, that brings us to the end of our study in Nahum. And we're going to move on next session to the next minor prophet. The next minor prophet will be the book of Habakkuk. So please join us for our next session. Thanks for being present here at this study in the book of Nahum. Lehi Thraot.